do it. You know, for field day, you know, I wanted to run a couple of batteries and, you know, that type of thing. And I didn't want to use my, you know, antennas attached to the house. You know, he's supposed to be separate. So, okay, I put together the, you know, a fan dipole. But I had a bunch of wires, so I just soldered it together, you know. And, like Roy said, you know, it's just a bunch of dipoles, really. When, you know, I did two. It sounds like he had three. The only problem, I didn't want to keep them on top of one another. I wanted to separate them. So, I used trees on the ends of the property. And, you know, I didn't want them to touching one another. I don't know if that would have caused a problem or not. Roy might comment on what his was like. But I actually separated mine. So they were hung individually from the trees. So, you know, I wound up with four different ropes. So, you know, time-consuming, but I was younger. I didn't care. It was fine. And then I used the Kenwood 440 rig, and that had an internal tuner. And, for instance, at 80 meters, you know, I cut it for the CW portion of the band because I'm big on CW. But like Roy said, you know, when I went to phone, you know, on that antenna, you know, you really needed the antenna tuner. Back to you.
Okay, I might have missed something there. So you're saying on the single sideband, there was some sort of a matching problem with the fan dipole, but did I understand you correct on that, Paul?
Yeah, well, you know, I cut the 80-meter dipole, you know, a little on the shorter side for the CW, you know, and the end of the band. But, you know, when I wanted to tune up on the phone portion of 80, then, I just hit the antenna tuner switch, and I was able to use that as well. So, you know, depending on the rig, as long as you have a rig that's going to be able to adjust for that, you'd be fine. But, yeah, I mean, if you're going to do it without an antenna tuner, you know, if you pay for a phone, then you better, you know, cut it for the phone portion of the band.
Okay, no, well, thank you. I misunderstood that a little. Yeah, certainly, yeah, you know, my experience with dipoles, you know, they're narrow banded to what you cut them to, and then, not so much narrow banded that a tuner can't, make up for that. So, okay, very good. Yeah, I just want to know if there's any peculiarities or any effect of having those other, radiating elements next to it, even though they're not radiating at the moment, but they may interact. So I was just curious about that, but it doesn't sound like it. All right, Paul, thank you very much. Back to Ned.
Comment.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Paul. Thank you, John. There are little peculiarities. I noticed that when it rained outside, the resonance would shift ever so slightly. It was, you know, not that terrible. I was able to live with it. You can the separate legs of the fan dipole will shift the resonance a bit, and that's why you really have to be able to tune it up and tweak its length with the other legs of the fan dipole in a position that's going to be consistent with its long-term use. So, you know, you can't just kind of cut a fan dipole at the ground, just splay it all over the place, and then mount it up and expect it to be resonant at the right frequencies.
Comment?
Yes.
Hi, Brian, KF2ZC. So I've been listening to this, and it's very interesting. Paul, you mentioned that when you went from 40, when you had your antenna cut for 40 meters, you were also able to go ahead and operate on 15. And I think this, again, comes back, and I have to study up on this, and I will do that. But you may, I this must have to do with harmonic. But the question is, what generates the harmonic?
Okay. Well, yeah, that, you know, you're going to get involved with the frequencies, you know, if you, let me think back. I'd have to think about it now. You know, it has to do with, you know, whatever frequency you're talking about, you know, halfway down that, you know, down from that frequency, you're going to have, you're going to have a harmonic, you know, frequency, and, you know, 40 happens to be one of the ones that, when you do that, you're going to get 15 out of it. I think, you know, that's the deal on the harmonics, and that, I don't know if it's halfway, or is it one-third, I forgot. Roy, he probably remembers, but, it has to do with the whatever frequency it is. Like, if you're on 80, you're going to get a harmonic, and you'll be able to operate another frequency. You won't be able to get 40, but, you know, you might be able to get 15 as well on 80. You know? So, yeah, it helps to do that. What I like doing, when I made these are, well, it's one antenna, but it's really two in one. And I figured, let me do this for free. I need some insulators. What should I use for insulators? So years ago, the bottle caps on water bottles were heavy duty. You can't do it anymore. But they were pretty heavy duty. So, okay, I'll just use a bunch of bottle caps and four of them. And took a bunch of ropes, tied it to the trees. Ran it to my tent, would set up the tent in the backyard, you know, battery, had a blast on field day. Back to you, WSUF.
Okay, Brian, I really don't like going into electrodynamics. We'll give it a try, and hopefully I won't confuse the heck out of you. It's basically the way kind of Smith charts and all kinds of things wrap around. When you have something at resonance, it has its lowest frequency. If it's a sensor-fed dipole, it's a half of a wavelength to the right, a half a wavelength to the left, and the center feed is the lowest impedance of about 50 ohms. Now, if you double the length of either both of those legs, the impedance from the feed line goes from 50 ohms to infinity ohms. And if you increase that another half of wavelength, it goes around like a circle, and you end up in the same place that you pretty much started, 50 ohms. So it's these harmonics is multiple, odd multiples that cause the impedances to rotate at 60 degrees and end up in roughly the same place. Now, an extended multiple length antenna can be resonant, but it doesn't necessarily have the same radiation pattern. It may have distorted nodes, peaks and valleys of energy along the antennas, but for all intents and purposes, it provides the same antenna point impedance and so transfers most of the energy to a multiple length of the antenna. So that's why harmonics work the way they do.
So it's a function of the antenna, not the transceiver. In other words, when you transmit, let's say on 7.150, you're transmitting on 7.150. There's no harmonics that are generated by the transmitter. It's by the antenna that creates the harmonic. Would that be correct?
Yeah, harmonics are, in this case, harmonics are primarily a characteristic of a given antenna design.
Okay. Okay. Well, I'd like to thank everyone who commented, and of course you, Roy, as well. I'm going to go ahead and study up on this. I really want to understand. I don't want to understand antenna physics to the nth degree, but I certainly want to become more knowledgeable about, you know, certainly, you know, how you get different harmonics available with just one wire, which is in the case of an end-fed half wave or an end-fed, you know, how that occurs. That is of great interest to me. And also to find out about generating a harmonic with a with, let's say, a fan dipole, for example, or what Paul had to say, where you could go ahead and transmit on 40, but yet it's resonant on 15. So it seems like a little bit of deep science, and I will go ahead and research that further. Thank you very much, all of you. Bye bye.
Once again, you're welcome, Brian. John, you wanted to say something?
Yeah, Brian, there's several different ways you can look at it, and one of the ways is the way that Roy explained it. Another way that's more visual, I'm assuming you're familiar with the sine wave. So if you looked at the sine wave, and you did it from a zero to its peak, to a zero, to its negative peak, back to its zero. And now if you increase the frequency three times in that same amount of space now, it would complete three cycles. And what you'll find is when it completes the three cycles, if you look where the zero point is with the original fundamental frequency, it will line up at the zero point. So thereby, the impedances will be matching at that point for both frequencies. It works only on the third harmonic, the third triple of the frequency. It might be something there, you know, I've always found things, and for me, visual always works better. So I just thought that might give you a little a heads up.
Oh, I appreciate that. I do have to go ahead and understand how harmonics are generated in the first place with antennas. You know, once I understand that basic concept, I should be able to go ahead and understand it even further and apply it to, you know, simple antenna designs. I just want to understand how, you know, harmonics are created. But I will do that. No big concerns. I have some good books here, and I will go ahead and look for them. Thank you for your comment, John.
I'm just not comfortable with the term being generated, even though you can say they're generated, you transmit, you're generating harmonics. A harmonic is just, if you take the space that one complete sine wave completes in, and now you take double frequency, well, now you're going to have two sine waves in the same space. That's going to be your second harmonic. And then there'll be your third harmonic. It's all within the same amount of space that in time that a cycle completes itself. So I guess it's accurate to say they're generated. They are generated. But in this context here, as far as understanding it, when you're transmitting, yeah, you're creating harmonics because you're having resonant circuits that can receive those harmonics, but just understand what harmonic is first. It's just the amount of time that it takes to complete a cycle, and then if you double that, will that be your second harmonic? And if you double the frequency, now it's completing three cycles in the same amount of time, that's your third harmonic. Just understand what harmonics are.
Okay, John, I agree with you, and then I don't agree with you because you kind of veered all over the... I don't think you could properly say that we're talking about the generation of harmonics. What we are talking about is how harmonics inherent that are received are treated by the given antenna. that an antenna that's capable of it will receive a harmonic of its tuned resonant frequency and transfer the power to your receiver, and you'll receive it. But the radio didn't create the harmonic. The harmonic frequency, the happenstance of the antenna design, and the harmonic frequency was transmitted from some other guy who doesn't know what the primary resonance of your antenna is. He generated a frequency because the frequency is a harmonic resonance tuned to the antenna. It allows the transfer of power from the antenna elements to the transmission line and to the receiver.
Yeah, I think that's what I said. You're saying it maybe slightly differently, but I started off with saying I wasn't comfortable with saying generating harmonics, defining what a harmonic is, and then I said, you know, because it is used a lot, people are saying, well, you're generating harmonics and you're causing TBI in the old days and stuff, so is that inaccurate? Well, I'm not going to say it is, you know, because you're generating harmonics, you're transmitting on more than one frequency. I just wanted to give him a basic on first understanding what harmonics are, and then you can use these descriptions of generating harmonics and everything. But I think I said what you said, and I agree with everything that you just said.
WS1.
Yes, Paul.
Now that John mentioned the one-third part, that rung a bell. Anyway, you know, I have all the books on the shelf here, and it shows that if you put in, for instance, 7.250, which is, you know, 40 meters, 250 kilohertz, and you put in what's the harmonic, the different harmonics, and they have the first harmonic, the second harmonic, and, well, the third harmonic is 21.75, so sure enough, that's 15 meters. Back to you, Roy.
Yeah, it's basically it's half-wave odd multiples. And John, yeah, I agree. At the beginning of your description, I agreed completely with you, and then when you kind of started to talk about generation as well, I don't really think you could properly say in this particular case that harmonics are generated by the transmitter. If the transmitter is locked onto frequency, the cut of the antenna is not going to do much. What happens with the cut of the antenna is what multiple half-wave frequencies will see the same impedance as its resonant impedance. And so just be efficiently conducted down to the receiver circuit.
You break up a little there, Roy. I wish you would go to the RF. Sometimes you just break up there, but so I didn't follow it completely. I don't know where the point of contention is. It might be just because I'm not understanding you. Not because of what you're saying, but because of your transmission. It's just, I don't know, maybe just a way of saying it, whatever. And like I said, I wasn't comfortable with saying you're generating harmonics, but then again, you are. I mean, if a receiver is receiving it, it's receiving something that you've generated. Now, it's tuned to your third harmonic, and that's where it is. You know, like going back to the spark gap transmitters, you were transmitting on every frequency, basically, you know, that was possible. So, again, if you want to try to restate, I'm just not sure what you're really taking issue with.
Let's talk one more time. The signal is not generated by your antenna. It's not generated by coax. It's not generated by your receiver circuits. It's generated by some other guy out there who doesn't know that you're using a 40-meter dipole to receive his 15-meter signal. That's where it's created. So nothing else in the chain is generating that signal. Conveying the signal, but it's not creating the signal.
No, I don't think this is something worth really debating, but I because it's just a matter of how you look at it, because how are you receiving a signal that, according to what you're saying, doesn't exist? When you are transmitting on a frequency, you're also transmitting harmonics. You're transmitting harmonics because if you weren't transmitting harmonics, there would be nothing to receive. You're taken to the position that, a 7 megahertz signal can be received on a receiver that's tuned to 21 megahertz, which is accurate, but there are harmonics being transmitted. I mean, I think it's very well documented, but
there's a difference between I'm the receiving station. I'm not creating the frequency. The frequency is primarily created at the harmonic frequency, and simply because of antenna design, rather than being rejected because it's not the primary resonant frequency, it's a multiple of. So I think we're kicking a dead horse here. I thank you as always, John. You always keep me jumping, and I really do appreciate it.
Yeah, I just think maybe you're looking at it strictly from the receiver point of view, and maybe I was just leaning too much into the transmitter point of view. Because I agree, again, I agree with everything you say 100%. But your description was strictly from the receiving point of view, and I was, I think, trying to add into it from the transmitting point of view. So, okay, back to you, Roy.
Thanks to everyone tonight. I had a lot of fun. I hope you had a lot of fun. I hope you'll be able to join us next Sunday when we'll be doing this again. After next Sunday, I'll be taking off a couple of weeks because of the Jewish holidays. So get it while you can. So once again, thanks. I'll be back later on. But now it's time for Paul WS2N with the SpaceNet Report.
Thank you, Roy. Okay, very good. All right, we'll do this. Although, in my opinion, the technical end of antennas is a lot more important than what rocket took off last week. Anyway, this is WS2N for the SpaceNet report for the TechNet. And this morning, a rocket did take off, a big one from Florida. It was a Falcon 9 Heavy. Launching the Nancy Grace Roman Space Telescope. It's an important mission for NASA and the science community. This telescope is large. They say it's around 44 feet long, and it's as wide as the Hubble Space Telescope. Nancy Grace telescope is, I would say, a big step ahead of the Hubble Space Telescope. That thing launched in 1990, had a big, roughly an 8-foot diameter mirror, and we've got great science from it ever since. This telescope, actually, they needed a mirror about the same size. So when the Hubble was developed with the 8-foot mirror, the National Reconnaissance Office decided to duplicate that mirror. And the only difference is,
NRO, what they use that their telescope for is not for looking out into space. They're looking down on the ground. They want to see teeny tiny objects, you know, to see what our adversaries are doing. But as far as I know, they might have had another one that they actually built, but then they had another one left over, you know, sitting in the, I guess in the garage somewhere with this gigantic mirror. So they got NASA people got the bright idea to take that mirror that's not being used and create a space telescope out of it, which they did. And the results from this thing are going to be phenomenal. You know, you've seen the pictures of the Hubble. You know, whatever field of view they see, this thing's going to have the same power as that Hubble. The only difference is the field of view is going to be about 100 times greater. So, you know, if Hubble took one picture, Nancy Grace Telescope telescope takes one picture, so it's like taking 100 pictures, 100 pictures from Hubble. So it's going to be a big, big game changer for the science community. So I watched this thing go off this morning at 7:30 on the Falcon 9 Heavy. Falcon 9 Heavy has 27 engines, Merlin engines. Pushes around over 5 million pounds of thrust and has a lot of fuel on board, enough to push this thing to where it's got to go. It's not just going into orbit like Hubble. Hubble is, what, 350 miles high in orbit around the Earth. Nancy Grace telescope, they're sending that out to the L2 position, Lagrange Point 2, and that's about a million miles away from Earth. So, like the Moon is like roughly a quarter of a million miles from Earth. Well, this is four times that distance of the Moon. And that's where it's going to sit. Other telescopes have been out there, including the James Webb Space Telescope that's still there. And hopefully it'll be there for another, you know, maybe 10 years. So this one's going to join it. It needs to be out in cold temperatures because, similar to James Webb, this thing has the capability of going near infrared, which they need low temperatures for their detector on board. But it also has visible capability. So, like I said, it's going out to L2, you know, there's L1, 2, and 3, and 4, and 5 different locations. L1 is a million miles from Earth, but it's in the direction of the sun. L2 is a million miles from Earth, but it's the direction away from the sun. And that's where this thing's going to sit. So as the Earth goes around the sun 365 days, this thing will do the same. It's not going to be orbiting Earth. It's actually going to be orbiting the sun. Like Earth is in a heliocentric orbit, so will Nancy Grace. So we'll see how it goes. It's going to take a long time to get there, just like Hubble did. James Webb Space Telescope took a long time to get out there. You know, it took many, many months. This thing will take roughly 3 months to get out to Lagrange Point 2 as well. Usually brings up the question, well, if it's a million miles away, how come it's going to take, you know, almost 100 days to get there? When it takes 4 days to launch a rocket to, you know, to go to the moon, to eventually put astronauts into orbit around the moon. It's going to take, well, it's going to take 12 days to make it to Lagrange Point 2. And that's because if they went at that speed, they'd have to have a much bigger rocket because you'd have to slow it down when you got there. So what they do is they launch it and they make it go fast enough, which is, you know, they have to go over 25,000 miles per hour to get it out of Earth orbit. But then as it's drifting all the way out to Lagrange Point 2, it's actually slowing down. It's slowing down, you know, to 10,000 miles an hour, to 8,000. And eventually when it gets out there, it's going almost zero. 0 miles per hour away from Earth until it gets to that happy point where the gravitational pull and the centrifugal pull of the Earth keeps it pretty much located in one spot. You know, yeah, it's in what they call a halo orbit. It's out there and it's moving around, but doesn't need very much power to do that. Could stay there for virtually, you know, years, and hopefully they'll do just that. So, yeah, any questions about Nancy Grace before I go on? WS2M.
I have a quick question for Brian, KF2ZZ.
Okay, I heard Brian, and was that John?
Yes, Paul.
Fine. I heard first, so go ahead, Brian. WS1.
All right, I'll make this very, very short. Is it going around the Earth for an orbit or two and then being slingshot out, or is it already on its way?
It's already on its way. Yeah, this big heavy rocket successfully got it into space, and then the two boosters separate, and they come back down, and they actually land back in Florida. The center core, when they launch the heavy, which is really three Falcon heavies at the same time, the center core, they let that go into the ocean, and then the upper stage has another Merlin engine on board, over 200,000 pounds of thrust on that, and that pushes them, in this case, out of the influence of the Earth. So yeah, it's on its way. And like I said, it's going to take 100 days before it gets to where it's got to go. Then, you know, I mean, they're going to run tests and everything, you know, make sure everything's okay. And so far, the last report I heard a couple hours ago, it's in good shape. Back to you, Brian.
That always fascinates me, the amount of energy that it takes to bring it there. But yeah, you need fuel to slow it down and then eventually stop it cold. So the mathematics must be pretty complex.
That's true. They have that down to a science. I always equate it to, let's say if I wanted to throw a baseball on top of a roof, you know, just wanted to get it to somebody that's up on the roof. You know, if I throw it in, I don't throw it hard enough, it's not going to make it. He's not going to be able to reach it. And if I throw it really, really hard, I'm going to pass him, and it's going to keep going, and it's going to go, you know, over to the next building. He'll never get a hold of it. You would need, like, somebody else to reverse it and throw the ball back down to him. So you have to throw it where, you know, it's going maybe 80 miles an hour when you throw that ball. But by the time it gets halfway up, now it's going around 30, 40, and then by the time it gets to him, it's barely crawling, almost stopped. He reaches out and grabs that ball, and then he can put it back onto the roof where he wanted to put it. So it's that type of thing, Brian.
Okay, thanks. John's next.
line business. Thanks for that question anyway, Brian. John, go ahead, WS2S.
Yeah, first of all, thank you, Paul. Very, very interesting. I don't want to misquote you. I believe you said, so correct me if I'm wrong, is this going to be orbiting the sun? Did I hear that correct? And just to let you piggyback on the next question, which would be, when will it actually be operational? November 2 is Charlie W2S when?
It'll get to L2 location, a million miles from that, from here. They say roughly about 100 days. As we speak, they're putting it into operation, the solar panels and all of that. And they'll be testing things over the next couple of months. And then they always go through a period, even with the James Webb Space Telescope, when it's out to where it's got to be, they'll set it up for what they call it commissioning. That will take some time. So probably, I'm going to guess probably 4 months from now, no more than that. And there was the second part of that question. What was that, John?
Yeah, I just, and forgive my ignorance with orbit and everything. Will this telescope be in an orbit around the sun? Is that what you said? Or will it remain just stationary at one spot out in space?
Oh, yeah, it's an orbit around the sun, just like Earth is orbiting the sun. If you were to take a measurement of the speed of Earth going around the sun, I think it's roughly around 66,000 miles per hour. So essentially that's what this thing is doing. It's going around the sun at 66,000 miles per hour. It's sitting four times away from Earth as the moon. Like the moon is orbiting the Earth. This thing's not doing that. This is just going to be sitting out there. But 6 months from now, it's gonna be on the other side of the sun. It's kind of like following Earth. What happens is, you have the orbital, the velocity of Earth and of this vehicle, going around the sun. And the reason for it, is gravity and the centrifugal force of the two are equal. So that's why the Earth doesn't, go barreling into the sun. And at the same time, the Earth doesn't fly off into deep space to join Pluto. The two of them, Earth and James Webb Space Telescope and now the Nancy Grace Space Telescope, all do the same thing. They are essentially orbiting the sun, heliocentric orbit. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Paul. I thought, just as a side note, I never knew that the speed of the Earth's orbit around the sun was that great, so I thank you for that. All right, Paul, back to you. I'll be listening.
Yeah, it's amazing. You can get a rough idea of doing that, too, if you ever want to remember it. The distance between Earth and the sun is 93 million miles. So, and then you double that, and you're going to get the diameter of the whole process of Earth going around the sun. And you say roughly a little over three times that, 3.14, is the circumference, times the diameter. And so you multiply two times the distance between Earth and the sun, which is 93 million miles. You double that. Then you
roughly triple that, and you're going to get this whole circumference of where the Earth goes around the Sun. It's an amazing big number, and then you divide that, you keep dividing it until you get down to the hour, and you wind up with, I think it's around 66,000 miles per hour. But it's, if you want to remember that speed, you just do that number, you know, you could almost do it in your head to bring it back and into your upper thoughts. Back to you, John.
Maybe you're going to do it in your head. I got to wrap my head around it, first of all. Thank you very much. Very interesting. Please proceed. Thank you.
Okay, very good. Very good. And by the way, Nancy Grace, she lived into her 90s, you know, when she was younger. She probably, you know, she really fought to become an astronomer. She wanted to do it as a kid, and she stuck with it her whole life, and eventually, you know, went from one college to the next, and became a professor, and wound up with NASA. And early on, she pushed for a space telescope. I think it was like in the 50s or 60s or something. She pushed, you know, let's put a telescope into space. It would be a great idea. And as time went on, you know, it caught on. And eventually, there were a couple of telescopes that were, you know, smaller ones that were put into space. But she wanted to put a big one into space. And sure enough, that became the Hubble. And what happened after that, because of that, she got to become, she's known as the mother of Hubble. And sure enough, the next big telescope that went up was this one. And let's name it after Nancy Grace Roman. And that's what happened there. Let me drop it, WS2M. Okay, I don't want to leave the L2 topic soon, right now, because there are two other spacecraft, smaller ones, sitting out there, hanging out, going around the sun at 66,000 miles per hour. But they're in that same location where they're able to use practically no fuel. It's a very happy place, and that's one of the reasons they use it. So there's two spacecraft. One's called Blue, the other one's called Gold. And they were launched by a Blue Origin New Glenn vehicle when they first launched that vehicle. They put these two spacecraft into that location, the L2. The goal for the Blue and Gold spacecraft is actually to go to Mars. So what happened was they were ready to fly. They were built by Rocket Lab. Rocket Lab had these things ready to go years ago. But the rocket wasn't ready to go. When I say the rocket, New Glenn wasn't ready, being built by Blue Origin. That's a heavy lift vehicle, you know, that competes with the Starship. And because that wasn't ready, you know, these two sat on the side. The mission was called Escapade. Escapade had these two satellites. But time took by, and they said, well, since we're going off on this big rocket, why don't we just send it out to the L2 location instead of sending it directly to Mars? And we'll wait for the Mars and Earth conjunction to get close to one another, and then they'll ignite their engines. They have these hydrogen rockets on board each one. We'll ignite them, and we'll push our way out of the L2 location, and we'll get caught up in to a trip using gravity assist of Earth and everything. We'll push ourselves all the way to Mars. They plan on doing that, and they will actually be leaving that location actually a month or two before Nancy Grace arrives. I was thinking, well, you know, maybe the two can meet up, but what's going to happen? Blue and Gold will leave the L2 location and head to Mars. I believe this November, Nancy Grace gets, I think it's within a couple of weeks of one another. So anyway, that should be an interesting deal, because once they get to Mars, they're going to put themselves into orbit around Mars. They call them CubeSats when I first heard about it. CubeSats are, you know, 10 centimeters by 10 centimeters. You know, they're probably 4 inches by 4 inches square. Cube that they've been launching for years. And they said, this thing's a cube. But, well, yeah, it's a cube, but it's 3 feet by 3 feet. These are pretty large spacecraft. They'll eventually put themselves in orbit around Mars. So we'll see. I talked about these two when they were launched. You know, back in November of 25, that was almost 2 years ago. Almost a year ago. This November would be 1 year. And then they'll leave, and then they'll actually get into orbit, I believe in 27, I believe the fall of 2027, they'll reach Mars, and they have enough fuel on board to slow themselves down, to put themselves into orbit. So, we'll see. They use these L2 and L1 locations quite a bit. Like I mentioned earlier, L1 is a million miles from Earth, but closer to the sun. We have a couple of stationary satellites out there. Stationary is a bad word. You know, that would be like what John said. You know, like, it's in one position. Again, the L1 position is also going around the sun, roughly about 60,000 miles per hour. And we have a couple of spacecraft out there. SOHO is out there, and Discover is out there, and that always gives us our the readings from the sun. You know, when you have a solar flare or something, they'll react to that and give Earth a early warning on whether or not we're going to get hit with a solar flare, which could disrupt the ionosphere, change all the ham radio signals that we deal with. Anyway, that's an update on Blue and Gold. We'll talk about that more in November when they leave that orbit and head to Mars. WS-20.
Who's leaving to Mars?
Yeah, well, that's the Blue and Gold spacecraft. We'll talk about that. Did anybody see the eclipse on the cloudy day that I talked about last week? Last Thursday was the eclipse. I got to see clouds.
I have a friend in France who went ahead and observed it with a friend of his who's a photographer, and they did a time-lapse video.
That's great. And they really had a true total solar eclipse. We had, 95% or something. Of course, I didn't see anything with the clouds. I knew somebody in Toronto.
That time complete.
In L.A., and, you know, no problem. Long Island, problem. Then I gotta wait until, I think it's June of 2029 to see another another lunar eclipse. Solar eclipse, of course, is different. But, yeah. I wonder what the weather is going to be that day.
shoot me an email, Paul, I think I could email you the video.
And you could, well, my email is, we always talk about that in the beginning of the net, it's spacenetreport@gmail.com, spacenetreport@gmail.com. Back to you, Brian.
All right, let me see if I can dig it up. Give me a couple of minutes. I'll try to get that to you. He's in like mid France, near Germany, and it wasn't a total. It was a, it was like 90%, 95%, 96%.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Very good. Yeah, you can send that anytime, tomorrow, whatever. I'll look at it. Not tonight, though. But, yeah, that, thanks for doing that, Brian. And, I just want to know, well, the Falcon 9s are launching, like, every other day now, either from California or Florida. And now they've decided that they're not going to launch any more Starlink missions with the Falcon 9 from Florida. You know, they've literally put 11,000 satellites into orbit. When I say they, SpaceX. And they're now going to any more Starlinks will launch from California, from Vandenberg Air Force Base. Florida flights are now canceled as far as Starlink is concerned. They'll keep launching Falcon 9 rockets. They still have to launch a crew. I think in a week or so they're going to launch another crew to the International Space Station, and they'll use it for other commercial flights. They just won't use it for Starlink. And they plan on eventually just using the new Starship to launch future Starlink satellites. Like, we need more of them, 11,000. Okay, I wanted to talk about the land that Elon Musk wants to buy up in Louisiana. I think I talked about it last week. Anyway, they're going to buy 18 miles of coast along the Gulf of Mexico. And they plan on building countless launch facilities there. He wants to be able to launch hundreds of these Starship missions over the future. In the next 10, 20, 30 years, he wants to do hundreds, if not thousands, of these flights. We'll see. He needs land for it, and now he thinks he's going to buy up 18 miles of coastline. I guess that's what you do when you don't know what to do with your money, but we'll see. I mean, can you imagine that? I know there's some pushback on him doing that, but I haven't looked to see on the map where it is yet. I should have done that, but I haven't gotten a chance. I don't even know if it's near New Orleans. It must be probably west of that, I guess. You know, what's he going to do when there's a hurricane? We'll see. For now, I'm looking at the time, run out of time. Thank everybody that participated, John and Brian and everybody else that listened, tried to get in there, couldn't, because I probably keyed up too fast. And we'll turn it over to Roy. We'll be back on the air tomorrow with the Limark Club InfoNet. That starts at 8:30. It's always followed by Swap and Shop, followed by Radio Newsline. For now, Roy, over to you, AC2GS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report, for the TechNet.
Yes, this is AC2GS. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the SpaceNet report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and what you do for the club. We all appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who participated tonight. I hope you had fun. I hope you come back, and we'll talk some more. As is my usual habit, I'll tell you some closing statements from some wise people, one being our own Dick K2RIW. He would always end his technical nets with the good advice to be kind to each other. That's always good advice. And I like to always mention good old Epictetus. It's impossible for a man to learn what he thinks he already knows. So keep your mind open to new ideas, but not so wide open that it pulls out, because you're going to need it one of these days. Anyway, guys, have a great week. Stay safe, be well, and if you can, join me next week when we'll try and do this all over again. This is AC2GS, and I will be clear after I say Slava Ukraini.
Roy, thank you very much. Paul, thank you very much. Paul, I just sent the video to you. Let me know if you did not receive it. Have a good evening, everyone, and thank you again.
Yes, I will thank you.
Roy, did I hear you were on vacation?
Oh, yeah, I doubled.
Jewish holiday.
Right. Thank you very much. I just heard it come up. You're welcome.
Yeah, sure. John. Yeah, John. Holidays. It's Rosh Hashanah. So I have to go back to the 17th.
Okay, sir. You will be missed. What'd you say? You're going to be gone for 2 weeks?
Yeah, the holidays come out on the weekend, the 13th and the week after, the 20th.
Okay, sir. We'll be here when you return. Thanks for everything. November 2, Zulu Charlie, we're clear.
You're welcome, John. Thank you for your... Go ahead.
Roy, do you ever play Jewish football?
Say again?
Jewish football.
No.
I have.
Okay.
Happy holiday season. Be well and thank you again.
Thank you. Yeah, I got the joke.
Okay, I tried. Whatever. 73, just be well. And be in touch.
Okay.
L repeater.